Blog Talk Radio.
Going through the
Radio. I'm your host, Tony Nix. Welcome to another night of discussion, opinion, and views. Tonight we're talking about the 50th anniversary March on Washington and your reaction to President Obama's speech that was given today in honor of the anniversary. Our call-in number tonight is 424-258-9271. Press 1. I know you're in the queue. You can join in on our conversation. If you choose not to join in, don't press 1, because if you do, you'll come up in the queue, and I'll screen you to find out who you are. Again, the call-in number is 424-258-9271. Also, our chat room is open. Feel free to leave your comments in the chat room. There'll be addressed in accordance to how they come in. Also, if you can't get into to the chat room and you're on the Blog Talk Radio site, what you really need to do is log in via Facebook or Twitter, and that'll bring you into to the chat room. Also, if you do call in, please be aware of background noise, what have you, because this is being taped, and I would like to have a clear taping. So, you know, make sure you got the kids and cat and dog and everybody else and radio and TV cut down so that we can hear you and not what's going on in the background. You're listening to Enough is Enough. Save Our Children Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Tony Nix, founder and president of Enough is Enough, Save Our Children, based here in Southeast Queens, New York. Again, tonight we're talking about President Obama's speech that was given today. We want to know what your reaction is. What did you get out of it? Was there any message of hope given or inspiration? Was it about change, or do you feel like it's the same old, same old? This is what we're talking about tonight. Again, call-in number is 424-258-9271. I'm going to go right to the phone lines. Got a sister on the line. And that is Sister Bonita.
Well,
good evening. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Tony. How are you?
Great, great. Thanks for calling in tonight. So let me ask you something, Sister Bonita. Did you see the speech that our president gave today?
I did not see all of it. I forgot it was Eastern Standard Time, and I'm Central Standard Time, so I only got about maybe 10 minutes of it. I have seen some clips of it. So, to be honest, I just haven't heard anything that I'm impressed with. I think there was a lot of nostalgia, and rightfully so, the 50th year. Giving honor to that speech, but I didn't really hear anything as far as policies that he's doing right now or this country has done for the last 10 years to change the demise of the black community. So I have little to say. I wasn't very impressed. But in all fairness, I only heard about 10 minutes of the speech, so.
Well, that's pretty fair. You know, I'm glad that you're being very honest about it, you know what I mean? I listened to his speech, and I was looking for a fiery speech, number one. That was a mistake I made from the very beginning, waiting for him to be fiery. That's just not our president, okay?
No, that's not
still
his style.
Right. Still at the same time, I realized he gave a conservative message, you know. And he also gave a message of we have choices, and the choices are up to us. There's some changes that need to be made that he's going to try to get on his job and do what he needs to do in the White House and Congress, but there's some things that we as a people need to grasp a hold to. Because something
absolutely
that stood out that he said was that, okay, yes, times are tough and times are hard, but that is no excuse for a father to step up for his son or parents to do what they need to do. You know, that doesn't, you know, don't shirk your responsibility because of conditions. I thought that was a big message right there. You know, I don't know if other folks heard it, but I did. I heard it clearly. You know, he realizes, yes, we have come some distance, but there's a greater distance that we need to go because of the conditions of America, especially with African Americans. Especially
right.
With African Americans, you know, the high unemployment, the crisis of gun violence in America's inner cities, okay? Weak, when I say weak, black leadership in our communities, okay?
Mm-hmm.
These are the things that we need to grasp a hold to and pay attention to because we're not paying attention to those things.
Right.
You know, we're not paying attention to those things, and we're voting for individuals who don't have our best interests at heart, okay? They have their own agendas, and when they take our agendas to whatever state you're in, the state capital, they're met with, this is what you're going to do, and I don't care what your constituents say, but this is what you're going to do. So we
right.
have to stop allowing our elected officials to go to these state capitals, Albany or wherever you're living, and selling out the constituents. We pay these elected officials salaries. Okay? This deal broker attitude that they go to these state capitals with, we can't have no more of that. We can't have no more of that because our communities are suffering behind it. Let me ask you this.
You know, the whole saying is that how do you know that you don't know? And I think one of the challenges, I think we spoke about it Sunday, about awareness and how do you know that you don't know? I think the leadership that we have, I think they do a good job of being ineffective. I think that the solution and the
I like that.
And I think that they are using techniques that are no longer effective and are just unwilling to have some type of critical analysis and say, you know, we should be asking questions like, how is this working now? It worked 50 years ago. But how is it working now? And I think that the old leaders are unwilling to pass the baton to leaders like myself, yourself. And there's a need for innovation. There's a need to challenge what we're doing. And the insanity is to keep doing the same thing, expecting different results. And so I just think we're stuck on stupid. I mean, and I think we do it very well. I think one of the things that I thought was very amazing is that the emphasis was on the speech, or should I say performance versus policy. We as African Americans, our culture is an oral tradition culture, so we naturally are very good speakers, and I think we do very well in making good speeches. I think when we get to implementation, I think we are very challenged, and nobody is willing to say that. I mean, we do an excellent job of inciting passion and getting people riled up and, you know, getting our little runs and all that kind of stuff. But when it comes down to implementation, seeing a concept develop into fruition, I mean, we just are unwilling to say we're not very good at it. Any, you know, at this particular time, you know, we're just not very good at, like, you know, of making things happen. And so I just think that it's going to take, like you say, some honesty. You know, I call it butt-naked honesty, and just say, hey, y'all, this ain't working. You know, it's just not working. And if we're not, and one of the things that I find in working with white people, they are very good at reassessing. They always have an evaluative process to critique their effectiveness. And we never do that. At the end of the hour, we never say, last year we had at this conference 500, these were some goals, did we meet our objectives, yes or no? That process never happens with us. And so until we are willing to say, hey, until we're willing to do that, I just think that we can, we'll continue to have great speeches because we're good speakers. And so I just don't know what it's going to take for us to get out of that cycle or that mindset about speeches and making good points. Who cares? It's a good point. But after the point, do you have a procedure to make the point come to a point? You know, they were saying it's not about the, I think, what do we talk about? We say the illusion of inclusion, but it's not the inclusion, but at the end of the day, it's the conclusion. What happened at the end of it? What is the, you know, we're stuck on the illusion of inclusion, but I want to talk about the conclusion. At the end of the day, what is the conclusion? What is the bottom line result? And until we become result-oriented, and that's what policy is all about. That is what effectiveness is about, is about results. And until we're willing to take on that model, because in the past it was about having a voice, it was about doing it the way that we did, it ain't working anymore. And we just need to accept that and do something different. So that's where I'm at with it.
Well, what is our biggest hindrance? Do you think is our biggest hindrance?
I think I'm disappointed in the, I don't know if it's called the African American Psychological Association, sociologists, social workers, whatever all these organizations are for these mental health professions. I don't think we really understand the power of 400 years of psychological programming. And I'm disappointed that our mental health experts are unwilling to come up with techniques to help us in this that stand outside of the traditional white folk stuff. Because if the white, you know, they've done the research, they have their PhDs, they've done that, they went to the same school they went to, but if the white people don't clap and say, we agree, they lack the ability to stand independent. I could care less what you think. I've done my research. This is what we've come up with. We're moving forward so that our people can become deprogrammed from all this mess that we've gone through for the last 400 years. There's a lady, her name is Joy DeGruy. She's actually come up with this thing called post-traumatic slave syndrome, which is not a new concept. I've heard post-traumatic slave disorder by other social workers. There's another guy, James Small. He's talked about it. He's done a lot of things. But at the end of the day, once again, we have a diagnosis. We have a good story, but no solution. So now that you've identified that we have this, are we going to get rigorous enough to start implementing techniques to see what we can do to begin the deprogramming process? Now, that takes work. That's trial and error. That's when the work really begins. And so a lot of people are just unwilling to go against the grain because, you know, they don't want to sound too radical. It's outside the box. And so once again, this assimilation process is killing us. Because we have assimilated to the point that, well, I don't want to seem too radical. Well, my research doesn't really coincide with someone else. Who cares? When white people come up with what they think is right, they don't ask anybody's permission. They will stand on it till they die. This is what I believe with conviction. This is my research. And whether you agree with it or not, they're going to move on. We somehow, and that's part of the programming that they're in, we're all victims of this racism, this assimilation process. We're unwilling. Now, she has all this. She's traveling the country. She's giving speeches to white people. I don't understand that because they don't have post-traumatic slave syndrome. You know, so it's kind of like you've come up with the diagnosis. You're giving speeches to white people in colleges. You've wrote a book. But where is the implementation of taking it to the black community, to the churches, to the institution, and say, hey, look, we've discovered this, and here are some techniques to help us get out of it. So once again, you know, I don't know where she's going with it. I mean, she's wrote a book. She's got a website. I followed her on YouTube. She speaks at a lot of white universities. She has a great reputation. But at the end of the day, black folks haven't heard about it. So I don't even know, you know, and I think once again, we're still just kind of trying to make a name for ourselves. Still trying to prove something to white people. And it's kind of like, y'all, those days are over. We don't have to prove anything to them anymore. Let's do our stuff for our community and move around, because at the end of the day, white people really don't care about post-traumatic slave syndrome. So I don't even know why she's speaking to white universities. But if you look in her audience on YouTube, that's who she's speaking to.
Who are we talking about again?
Her name is Dr. Joy DeGruy, and I think it's D-E. J-R-U-Y, I can't be exactly right, but she's actually wrote a book, and it's called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. She'll never get it in the diagnostics manual because this country doesn't want to pay reparation, but and then there's some other social workers that have actually come up with something called Post-Traumatic Slave Disorder, recognizing and comparing it to what it means to be traumatized, and what she does is talk about the trauma, the toxic environment that we were raised in from generation to generation to generation, and all of the junk that we've picked up concepts of ourselves along the way. But at the end of the day, there's still not a solution. I got her workbook, but it doesn't really, I just wasn't impressed with the solution part of it, but it's a start. So I'm encouraged, but I don't see anybody, you know, I don't see her trying to take this and make it a movement and get other social workers on board, or maybe she's tried and maybe she's failed also because of what I'm talking about. So once again, I don't think we understand the impact of the psychological condition that this country has had for the last 400 years. We were less than a man, a person, from pictures being hung. I mean, it's just an atrocity, and I don't think we really understand the effects of conditioning, and your history will not cure conditioning. Insight will not cure conditioning. You have to go through a process to snap up out of it. Otherwise, what you hear black people going through when we talk about discrimination, and this is why when I talk to white people, well, we're discriminated against too, because black people are speaking from a place of being traumatized. We're not talking about discrimination like, oh, I didn't get the job just because I wasn't black. we're speaking from a place of being traumatized for hundreds and hundreds of years of being treated unfairly, unjustly. And so when we speak, we're coming from that place. And that's why we kind of lose the conversation with white people. And, and I stay specific with them because I don't say discrimination. I say we're speaking from a position of being traumatized and victimized. So we're talking, we're coming from a place of no equity because when you listen to them and they say, well, we didn't have any money, we were dead broke. Okay, but you had some form of equity, whether it was equity in being white, equity in knowing somebody. We didn't even have our own sweat equity. You had our sweat. We had nothing. And when you talk to them like that, then they go, oh, I got it. We didn't even have sweat equity. We had nothing. We was your sweat. So all the land you got that was transferred down to you, that was stolen from us, you know. So when we come, we are talking from a place of being traumatized and being cut loose of 400 years of atrocity with no therapy and no rights. And so when we're talking, we're not talking about just discrimination. We're talking from a position of being just traumatized. And so that's why you hear the energy in our voice and, you know, we can just get so worked up because, I mean, that's where we're coming from. We have been victimized. And unfortunately, a lot of people say, well, black people need to stop being a victim. One thing that a victim has to have before they can move on is somebody saying, we get it. You have a right to be upset. Nobody wants to tell black people have a right to be pissed off. And we're being told, oh, that's too dramatic, that we need to come. No, we need to be upset. And it is healthy to be upset because it says that I have finally am coming to a point that I realize I have been done wrong. And then when I realize that I can move from that position, but to be constantly told we don't have a right to be mad, to be constantly told to get over it, to be constantly told to stop being a victim. And the fact that the psychological community has not done anything to pivot and give us a voice is just disappointing. So, I mean, that's where I'm at with it. And like you say, once again, at the end of the day, I think we just have a lot of 60s babies that are still trying to, you know, climb the ladder, retire. And it's going to be the generation that's coming up that's got to have the voice. I'm through with the 60-year-old. I'm with you. Save the children. We've got to reach the generation that's coming up that understands the frustration of going to school, being in student loan debt, can't get a job, have student loans, defaulting on a student loan. So what, you got an education? Everybody talking about the great equalizer is education. No, the great equalizer is economics. And all this, you can have a PhD, and a PhD means absolutely nothing anymore in a lot of circles. You still can't get a job with a PhD. And we have PhDs in schools that are not even tenured in their universities. They're still associate professors. So we've got to have an honest conversation. Is education truly the only equalizer now? Or is it really the equalizer moving into the millennium? Or is economics the equalizer today? And so I just think we're comparing apples to oranges, and we're not really having a conversation critiquing what we're doing. So I mean, I don't know where I'm doing my part here, and in Lake Charles, and we're having the conversation, we're doing the hard talking, and I think we've got to have the hard conversation, because at the end of the day, Jesse Jackson, it's just time for him to sit down, Sharpton, it's just time for them to sit down, pass the baton. I can sit across from my white brothers and sisters that tell me that they don't think they owe me nothing. And even though I want to whoop their butt, I can sit there and keep my composure. You know, Sharpton had been through a whole bunch of stuff. He's still kind of stuck in the thing, and I understand that. But those of us that didn't have that experience, we come to the table with an advantage because we can listen to some of that stuff and not get so worked up and
discombobulated like they do. And we've got to be able to take our message and with the passion, we've got to, those of us that have the passion, we've got to understand there is presentation is everything. But I think the passion needs to be there. I think this kind of dull, you know, quasi like what kind of Obama did today, you know what I'm saying, this kind of conservative type thing. It's after 50 years, it's not time to be conservative. You get conservative when you've accomplished a lot of things. We don't have time to be conservative right now. We still need to be passionate about change, lack of change, and pressing forward. And if we don't bring that passion and we keep trying to come in with this assimilated, watered-down, subdued message, that's why people look at us and say, yeah, right, we've heard it all before, we're tired of it, we don't want to do anything, so... I'm through preaching. That's my soapbox.
Ooh, well, you know, some of it I agree and some I disagree. I agree with the passion. You definitely have to have a passion. The president, I did hear passion in his speech today. I didn't hear a lot of it, but I did hear passion. You know, first of all, you know, we're a very emotional people, Bonita. You know that. And I think that hinders us in a way. You know, excuse me. And we become more reactive than proactive because of it. Now, as far as deprogramming, I'm going to put it like that. Okay, yes, it has been years and years of oppression, which has manifested to, you know, internalized oppression and learned helplessness. And there are solutions for that, but the thing is, are people willing to shake that mindset? Are they willing to do something about that mindset? Because it's used as a convenience with us. It's used as a convenience with us not to do anything besides what we're doing. Yes, there is a conditioning. I agree to all of that. At the same time, you know, we can deprogram from that if we choose to. So there's a willingness that has to come forth that, you know, you said it, the key word, we got to get honest about the fact, do we want to still be chained down inside our heads?
Let me ask you this, Tony. Why do you think that a battered wife, okay, when they first, mm-hmm. when they came up with the whole battered wife syndrome, why mm-hmm. do you think a woman who starts out in a pattern loses mm-hmm. the ability, and this is what I don't think, this is the part that I think that when we do the motivation thing, we talk about where you got a choice. Choice means that I'm aware and I am cognitive and I can say A, B, C, D, F, G. When you start talking about learned helplessness, this is why women can stay in a house and can walk out the door any day and can't walk out. Because once you have been conditioned into learned helplessness, see, you lose your ability, and that's the part that I don't think really people really understand about learned helplessness, is that you lose the ability to have that thing called motivation, insight, objectivity. It's gone. And so it's like once you've conditioned that dog not to leave that gate, you can leave that gate open. He ain't going out. And when you get into learned helplessness, it is truly a condition that unless somebody gives you some insight, help you see where you are. You know, you have to tell the battered woman, it's kind of like, you know, like look in the mirror. You have to do all kind of stuff to try to help her see that she's been battered, because she uses language like, well, he didn't hit me that hard, or it wasn't really that bad. Or, I mean, you should hear the language of denial. It's kind of like drug addiction. I mean, it's kind of like when you're addicted. You see what I'm saying?
Right, I get it. So, the you know, you was going there, denial. You know, denial. That's another issue. That's another issue, and we're going to talk about that. But I got more callers on the line. I want you know, they've been patient.
Sure.
Don't go anywhere, okay? Because you brought up some really big some big points. I'm gonna go to my next caller, coming from the inside, and that's Brother Hest. Good evening.
Peace and blessings, family.
Peace, brother. How are you?
Man, I'm blessed and highly favored. How's the brother doing, man? That's my mentor. How you doing, big brother?
Listen, bro. Blessed and highly favored, you know? Blessed and highly favored, brother. You know, I can't make this happen without you guys, man. You ladies and gentlemen, I'm telling you, y'all are just outstanding, outstanding. So, you know, tonight we're talking about the I don't know if you heard it today or watched it, the speech that President Obama gave today at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Did you hear it or see it?
No, but I got to hear about it. You know, I'm in a situation where it's kind of hard to be able to control
the
viewing.
Right, I understand.
But,
right.
But I did get to hear a little bit about it, and you know, from what I also heard from like what the sister was saying, it also coincides with what you just said, that there were, you know, there were some points that was hit on, you know, and there were some actual opportunities to see that, you know, we have a lot of work to do. And one of the things that I do agree with is the psychological conditioning that we are faced against right now. You know, it is absolutely crazy how, you know, our people, as a people who have come out of the actual slave conditionings, refuse to really strong look at how the law has been coded, how the psychological field has been coded, how the economic fields have been coded, and we refuse to strategize and build think tanks in order to decode this and give the decoding process to those who have no money or opportunity to go and get a formalized education. You know, it's something where we need people to break it down, and like the brother of Man said, break it down child style so I don't miss. You understand? And that's one of the biggest biggest areas of being misguided that I see that our strong black brothers and sisters have basically allow, you know, to come about here in America. You know, we need someone to put these things down to us so that we understand why it's important for us to gain access to this area of education. Right now I'm sitting inside of a cell and I have, you know, the APA, the American Psychological Association Dictionary of Psychology. I have the Cambridge Dictionary of Sociology. You know, I have, you know, alliances and how to form alliances with others, you know, because it's important for us to be able to tap into the resources that other people have tapped into, just like they say there's nothing new up under the sun, you know, but are we actually obtaining this information and then breaking it down and becoming translators? You know, we got the brothers in Chicago called United in Peace, and they always blast out there the fact that, you know, we have urban translators, meaning that they go into the urban areas where it's gang-riddled, and we wonder why is that going on. And just like on the pop show, you know, they're speaking about the bullying. And the fact that what I'm seeing now is that we as a people have been bullied, you understand, through the slave mentality. And now that we're out of the slave conditions, we still have the same mentality of being victims, and so we're doing just like the children now. What we're doing is we're looking for the advantage point so that we can obtain some level of success in whatever area that we do have knowledge in or we succeeded in. And it's all about self. It's all about me, you know, but what about the people? What happened to us being driven to become educated, informed, and be able to, you know, succeed in life and then give back to those who don't have, you know, what it is that we were never given, you know? And that's one of the biggest things that I see. And, you know, I hope that the brother Barack Obama, you know, is able to achieve some form of initiating some strategic think tanks at some form of his last years in office, because we need it, man. We are sad, man. We are in a sad state, and it's like, man, me sitting here inside these cells, man, and I'm just watching it from the inside out. It's like, man, I've never wanted my freedom so bad just to be able to get on that front line with you, Brother Tony Nix, to get on the front line with that sister, you know, and get out here and begin to be able to translate our pain, our fury, our frustration, you know, our hurts, habits, and hang-ups and conditioning patterns to these people. And I hope that's what that lady that wrote the book, Joy, is doing, is that she's striving to show these white people what it is that we are in a state of. And hopefully, man, she can be able to open up the door to the American Psychological Association, being able to transform some form of a way to stop privatizing, you know, our psychologists, psychiatrists, and sociologists, and let them come in and help us, man. We need it, big brother.
Oh, yes, we do, Brother Hess. Yes, we do. Stand by. Don't go nowhere. I got my sometime co-host on the line. Oh, well, matter of fact, she hasn't called in yet, but you know who's coming up next. Matter of fact, I'm going to ask him to, can you just be patient for a minute, and that's Brother Mike X, because I have a lady on the line. It's her first time calling in, and I want to get her in on our topic for tonight. You're listening to Enough is Enough, Save Our Children, Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, we're talking about the reaction to, President Obama's speech he gave today at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. I'm going to go to my next caller, and that is Sister Ella. Good evening, Sister Ella. Can you hear me?
Hi, I think we're missing the boat. I think President Obama spoke well today. I am so sick of our people sitting around here waiting on somebody to give us a handout. We have to learn that nobody's coming to save us this time. Our children have to learn that we have to get our education. That's the most important thing. I lived a dream. In 1963, I was 13. And I know how it was and how it is. I've seen the back of the bus. I think we take this for granted. Education is the key. And we got to stop waiting on handouts and thinking somebody's going to come and save us. We are the ones going to have to save ourselves this time.
You know, I agree with you, Miss Ella. You know,
And this guy who was talking about in prison, like they get so educated in prison. I mean, it's just as hard to stay out of trouble as it is to stay in the trouble. We got to help our community and stop this black-on-black crime, killing each other. They don't care. We need to help each other understand that we got to honor each other, respect each other, and teach our kids that, hey, education is the key. You got to love one another, and we all in this world together. And racism is not going to be dead, but we need to understand that we need everybody, not just black, white. We need everybody to overcome this social economy that's going so bad, and we need to get into technology and train our kids the right and what is wrong.
Well, Miss Ella, I hear your wisdom, and I don't want you to go nowhere because I got this next brother coming on. And
I get so tired of y'all complaining all the time about what is wrong. We got a lot that is right with the world, but we want to make $10 an hour, but we don't want to get any training, don't want to do anything. We got to work. They didn't give it to me. I worked for all I had. And I love our brothers and sisters, but we need to understand there's no Martin Luther King coming. There's no other peoples are coming. We're going to have to stand up our own feet and do it ourselves this time. And we can do it.
Yes, we can. Yes, we can, Miss Ella. Don't go nowhere. Don't you leave. Stand by. I'm going to put you back on hold. I'm going to my next caller. That's Brother Mike X. Good evening, Brother Mike X. Are you there?
Peace, brother.
Peace, man. Thank you. Welcome back.
Hey, thank you. I'm glad to be here. And peace to the family as well. You want me to just go in?
So did you hear the speech today? Did you hear the speech today?
Brother, let me tell you something, man. You know, and we talked about this before. I lived this, like many of the callers on here, that, you know, we lived this. And, you know, we, you know, those of us who understand why today, you know, why we're in the situation we are today, you know, we know what the formula is, and we know what the formula is, and we don't necessarily get caught up in, you know, things. I don't want to say it's trivial, but in a way, I do think it is kind of trivial, you know. So I checked in and checked out, and, you know, I say all that to say I didn't watch the whole thing, bro. Yeah. And there's a reason why. You know, hello? Hello?
Can't hear any. Hello, can you guys hear me out there? Because I can't hear any.
I hear you. Hello? I hear you, brother.
Okay. Tom. Okay. I'm sorry. I lost. I couldn't hear anyone. I didn't get the last of what you said, Mike. So can you just get the last part? I was the only part I didn't hear.
Yeah. I'm all right.
I'm sorry.
I gave a long-winded answer to say I really didn't sit there and watch the whole thing. You know, I saw excerpts, and you know, I don't believe that our problem will be solved, you know, through the presidency, you know, as the main ingredient, you know, as the first line of the solution. You know, I believe that, you know, the solution is going to have to come from us. You know, I don't believe that the establishment, even with a black president, really wants to see black people particularly, you know, liberated, empowered, and able to compete, you know, in this American society, you know. And that belief, you know, makes me not be so caught up in what the president's saying or the observance of a 50th anniversary March on Washington ceremony, you know. So that's where I'm at. You know, and there's a few things, you know, that I would like to say on that if you have time, or, you know, if not, I can hold on and get them in later.
Yeah, well, if you can get them in later, that would help, because I got callers on the line, okay? I want to get everybody in, but, Mike, you know, not to go nowhere, because I'm definitely going to bring you back in. So, please, just be patient with us, you'll be able to bring those comments back.
No doubt.
Okay, so thank you. My next caller on the line, she's a mentor. She's my mentor, okay? She's a scholar out of Georgia. This lady carries a lot of wisdom. She's lived the civil rights movement. She's participated in the civil rights movement. She's a retired teacher, and she is my aunt. So please welcome my aunt, Aunt Minnie Ruth Lockhart, out of Atlanta, Georgia. Good evening, Auntie. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Welcome. Welcome to my show.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate that.
So you saw the president's speech today at the 50th anniversary March on Washington. Give us your view on that.
Well, if you want me to characterize him, when President Obama came on today, his speech may not have been as stimulating as he usually is. In fact, I watched him walking up to the podium. He was sort of somber. You know, I thought once, could it be the weather? But he has a lot on his plate with Syria and all of those things, but he gave an excellent speech. I've seen others who have analyzed it, and you always have to look at a person and see what lies beneath. And I think under that, we probably wanted to see a rousing one, but he definitely gave an outstanding speech in that he knows that it took all of that back there during the civil rights movement to get him where he is today. He knows that. In fact, when at his first inauguration, he wrote Congressman John Lewis, whom I met as well, and he told him, I wrote it down, he said, "Because of you, thank you, John." So the weight of a lot of things, international problems and what's going on, but he gave us two choices, and I think the choices in his speech is this: we can remain sedentary, that means we don't do anything and just think the world is all right, or this is a movement, and a movement never ends. I think sometimes we are short-sighted in that, oh, well, you know, during the first time in history we had he's not the first black president, but I'll talk about that some other time. But I'll just go on with this. The first time in history in our time we elected a black president, so everything's fine, everything's all right. The world is complex, and so we forgot until the midterm when he said that he had gotten a shellacking. And he was very measured. I'll be quiet.
No, go ahead, continue. I was saying yes.
Okay, he was very measured when he said that. Notice that he's very measured as he speaks at times. And because he could see the big picture. Brilliant people can see what everyday people don't see. That's what I'm saying. And I'm not saying all brilliant, because that would be an invalid generalization. But he knew the quiet storm would be a tsunami. And it really and truly worked out that way. Once the Tea Party, you know, got in, and of course we know what happened today. But back to his speech, it was, I think I looked at him and I could tell he was a professor, because he was talking to the audience and he didn't make it plain. There were a lot of innuendos and inferences and all of that. You would have to cut through all of that.
So, okay, do you think his message gave hope, inspiration? Was it about change? I mean,
yes.
You feel like all of them.
Yes, I do, because if we go into the surface structure of our brains, we would understand that, see, we want to narrow everything down, and I do it too. Well, it was because of this one thing, this happened. But life isn't like that. It's so complex that a lot of things are going on at one time. So I think he did, he really and truly did hit the high points. Did I answer the question?
Yes, you are answering the question, Auntie. I don't want you to go nowhere, because I have a couple of people on the line.
Okay.
And I know you have some insight on some of what they said. I know you didn't hear what they said, but I'm going to ask them to repeat it.
Oh.
So I'm going to put you on hold. Don't go anywhere, okay? I want to go to my next caller, and that's Dr. Edgar J. Scott out of California. Good evening,
Okay.
Doc. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's discussion, Doc. Did you see the speech today that the president gave at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington?
Yeah, I saw it.
What's your view on it? Did he give a message of hope, inspiration, change? What did you gather from it?
Well, I think it was probably from my perspective, one of the best speeches that he's given during his whole presidency, from my perspective. And I think it was a message of hope, and I think it was one that to me I resonate with what he has to say, what he said today, because it he talked about unity, and he talked about all people. I think we as humans get into this thing of black and white and separation, a separation philosophy, and he talked about we are one America, and I really liked him saying that, and I think he talked about racial politics, and I really liked what he had to say about that, and I think his message today was fantastic. And I think he gave us a roadmap on how we could get there. And my comment is, I think he talked about education, and I think part of the issue for us all is that it's going to take education for us to get there, because I think a number of people think about education, think that it's all about books. But if you're not a critical thinker and know how to think, I think you're a lost ball in high weeds. And there's a number of people that really don't know how to think. And I think what he's talking about is being able to think. But, yeah, he gave us the roadmap on how to get there, and I think it was fantastic.
All right, Doc, so, don't go nowhere, okay, because right now I'm getting ready to mix it up a little. I got
a
lady by the name of Sister Benita on the line, and, you know, she brought up something a little earlier, and I just wanted her to run that past my aunt, and I want to get my aunt's reaction to what she has to say. So don't go anywhere, Doc.
Okay.
Sister Benita, can you hear me? Sister Benita, are you there? Can you hear me? Okay, perhaps she can't hear me, but I can see that she's still in the switchboard. I'll come back to her, but in the meantime, I want to go back to Miss Ella. Miss Ella, hello, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Right, Miss Ella.
Are you there?
Know? Yes, yes, I can hear you clearly, Miss Ella. Can I ask, where are you calling from?
St. Petersburg, Florida.
Okay.
I'm from the good old state of Florida.
Well, great. Welcome again. Welcome.
I know y'all don't like Florida, but it's a good state.
Well, you know,
we have our ups and downs. I understand.
Same conditions everywhere. Same conditions. We're fighting the same
fight. Yes, it is.
Across the nation.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes,
so,
it is.
So, you know, I don't really think it's about whether you like. We don't like the treatment. That's what we don't.
I know. I know. It hurt all the God stand your ground, which I will be voting in 2014 to get rid of that sorry governor I got.
Okay. Well, Miss Miss Ella, you mentioned the fact that education was the key.
It's the key. Education, dear. It started with kindergarten and preschool. That's why they fight so hard to take it out of public school and get us charter schools. We don't need that. Education. And anytime you go into technology, the world is going into the world of technology. You want to make $10 an hour, don't have a training to do anything, and sit back and complain. I get sick of it.
Miss Ella, you know, you've got some valid points there. You know, no one even mentions that. I've not heard anyone mention the fact that you want to live in wage,
But does your education...
But you don't want to earn it. You want to sit back and complain and say, I want to make $10 an hour. What are you qualified to do?
But at the same time,
what can you do
really
to make
live?
The $10 an hour?
True, but you can't really live off of $10 an hour.
I know,
not
but
in,
honey, I'm telling you, we're living off less
country.
Than that.
Exactly.
We're living off less
exactly.
than that.
Absolutely
and it's important,
right.
But all, I'm not trying to say that I want the minimum wage to increase. What I'm saying is we got to understand that the world is going into technology. We're doing a lot of things, and we're not trying to educate our kids and teach them integrity, the basic of English writing and arithmetic. You get up there and can't even count your money, and you're losing and wonder why. And we can't sit back and blame the white man for all our troubles. We don't even want to go to school and do half what's right.
Mm.
I was taught, you go to school and you learn. They don't want an educated black person, I'm telling you. Once you learn, you cannot take that away from you. And, I mean, we need everybody, not just green, I mean, black people. We need everybody to help us make it in this world. And I've seen it. I've been here through segregation and desegregation. And I've been around good white people, bad black people. It depends on the soul of a person. And we are killing each other all, black-on-black crime. Want to blame the black man because we're killing each other. It's sickening.
Yes, it is, Ms. Ellen. It is sickening. Stand by. Don't go nowhere. I got Miss Benita back on the line. I wanted
I'm
to.
Have to.
Don't, if you have to leave, you have to leave. But you're welcome to stay, okay? But I want
yeah,
to get
but
back
to... I just want to stop blaming everybody. It's time for us to pick up the pieces. No more Martin Luther King is coming. We're going to have to do it ourselves. So I'm going to get off and let the rest of y'all talk and go head on. But I lived it, segregation and desegregation. And education is the key. If you don't get education, you're lost. A mind is a third train to waste.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And thank you so much for joining us tonight. I want to get back to Sister Bonita because she was talking about something, and I wanted my aunt to give a feedback on that. So
I'm going to listen to her, and then I'm going to get off.
Thank you. Sister Benita, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. You called drop before. I have my aunt from Atlanta, Georgia on the line, and you talked about conditioning. Can you give a brief,
sure.
repeat that so she can hear it? Auntie, your mic
sure.
is open. So,
sure.
So if you can hear me, Auntie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I have Sister Benita on the line. Listen to what she has to say about our conditioning, and then give a reply. Go ahead, Sister Benita.
One of the things that I don't think that we really comprehend is the psychological conditioning that we've been through for 400 years and how we have passed that down to family, to family, to family. And conditioning is when you have learned helplessness, you no longer have objectivity, insight, nor the ability to make responsible choices. And black-on-black crime, our concept of ourself that we have been handed down for generation that we're nothing, our features, our ways, our style, just everything about black people is on the top of the bad list, from how we talk, our facial features, our skin tone, our nappy hair, our kinky hair. I mean, there's nothing good about us. We start out in this world when we're born as black children, our parents start telling us we've got to be something versus celebrating that we are something. And so when you've been conditioned to think that you have to become something, and the first thing that we were offered was to become as good as whites, therein lies the faulty premise, because that's not good enough. And so I don't think we really understand that. So I think that since we have left the physical plantation, there is a mental plantation, and I think there needs to be understanding of how powerful conditioning is, because a history lesson will not cure conditioning, because conditioning is like a reflex. You know, it's like when you're on the table and the doctor hits your knee and he hits that right thing in your knee's going to go out. It's a reflex. You can have history. You can know all about your history. You can even know why you do something. But until you go through a process of instincting certain behavior, you will continue on. And so I think that there really needs to be some work done on the ground level of the conditioning that has happened to the black family, down from racism with black women, our attitude toward our men, our attitudes about ourselves, who we believe that we are as a people, and really coming up with something other than, you know, we don't, you know, we're still trying to decide, are we black, colored, Negro, Afro-American, African-American? I mean, we still don't know, because there's still an identity crisis going on. Are we going to say nigger with the E-R, nigga without the, I mean, we're still wrestling with who are we? And so I just think that there needs to be some work done on how do we begin to, I think a brother said, make it, put it in plain English, to begin the decoding process to kind of snap us out of the denial. And that's going to take skill, expertise on how to get into a lockdown mind. Because if you've never been, if you've always been aware, it's very difficult to understand what it means to be unaware. And I think that's the challenge. And I'll end with this. It's kind of like women, addiction. I mean, everybody else can see your life is falling apart, but you're so caught in the denial. The battered wife syndrome, she can leave out her house anytime, but once she's been beat down, she cannot walk out the door, even though there's not a lock on it. So those of us that have never been conditioned sometimes lack the empathy or the insight to understand what it means to be raised in a family that the only thing you know is crack cocaine, promiscuous behavior, violence. That's all you know. And that's all you've been exposed to. So for someone to come along and say, oh, just snap out of, you can be all that you can be, to think that you can just get some pep lesson and some pep talk and snap you out of that, I think is lack of insight on what conditioning is really all about. So that's my spiel.
Auntie, are you there? Did you hear what she just said?
Yes, and I understand that very well. I want to make two comments, and I'm going to have to leave myself, but it's very interesting. I think in talking with you, I've talked to you about my little study that I did on black boys and why they don't perform well in school, and she's that's a part of it, is the conditioning and watching and being very intuitive. I'll give you one example. Before I do that, I'd like to respond quickly. The professor and I were on the same wavelength. We talked about this, you and I. I mean, he resonated very positive with me, the president's speech, and I thought it was an excellent speech too. But back to what he says, which is going to piggyback on what the young lady said, it's the ability to think critical, to go into the deep structure of understanding self. I'll give you one example.
Before you do that, the gentleman that you're speaking about is Dr. Edgar J. Scott. His mic is open also. Doc, say hello to my aunt, Minnie Ruth Lockhart.
Hello, how you doing?
How are you, Dr. Scott? See, I thought I talked about this earlier, that President Obama was speaking as a professor, and he knew what he was doing. And it was intentional for him not to make it plain. But if you listen, see, there are many styles that you bring to a setting. There is a superficial style of listening, and there is the listening where you have to process. It's just like, as if you were reading a body of a novel or a short story. It all depends on how it's written that will cause you to have intense reading, a light reading, and you get to the point. So that's where I saw President Obama, and we are liking, I've taught this, critical thinking. I teach students until I would observe them. See, we're such a highly stimulus type people. I would just watch how they would come in, how they would sit down, how they would answer a question, and I would constantly, if they answered it and it was really off key, and then I would just redirect the question. So it's a lot going on with black people. I understand all of that. My son,
right.
This was the example that I was going to give based on the young lady that I was listening to. He says, you know what, Mom, you always told us we were great. I never thought anything. I always thought I was great. I always thought I could do anything I put my mind to. And so when he said that, I said, you know, well, my mother and father did me the same way. I mean, they said, oh, you really want to do that? You really want to try to paint? Well, let's see if you can do it. Try it.
Yeah.
They didn't say, don't do that. And so that is the problem. She's right about that. If I wanted the students, believe it or not, I taught high school students, if I wanted them to do something or I knew we were going to an assembly, I would prepare them for that. This is the way you do. When you go in an assembly, you're not going to talk. The person may be very boring. They're boring to me. But you have the impotence in you. You have that discipline because learning is a discipline. Well, you don't have teachers like me anymore, and I know that. Everything is measured until they get to the point that it becomes like breathing.
Right.
So we have the jobs, and that's why he was so measured and somber. He has the vision.
Right.
And he is very eloquent in his presentation. People are different. Dr. Shopton, Reverend Shopton, has the vision, but he's very patrician, forceful, and demonstrative. So it's a lot we've got to do to get our kids out of the Johnny One Note and self-image.
Right.
So that's it. I can go on, but that's it in a nutshell. We're going to get there. I won't see
that.
72. We are. It's going to be very difficult because we are so superficial in our thinking. We haven't read enough. Yes, you've got to read. Education is important. It is.
Right.
And so if we as parents don't value education and it's a beat down and loud talking and music and singing and dancing, everything has its place.
Right.
And singing and dancing, and we got to be dressed like the movie stars. It's super. It's an illusion. So we've got to get our kids out of the illusionary mode. And I thank you all for listening to me because I really can talk a lot.
Fonzie, it is a pleasure to have you on tonight. I called you earlier. I said, okay, let me call. Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you because, see, wisdom is what we need. We need wisdom. We need those that know, you know, that are not just talking in.
Right. We need to revisit. I told Al Sharpton one day, we need to stop watching Scandal and take our children and start with Roots. We need to revisit. It's about, I never would teach the children until you showed me your roots. You could get pictures, you could do whatever. But they've got to have a sense of self and know that we love them. No matter how they answer a question, they've got to know, first of all, that you are the role model. You model what you want your children to be. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely right. I'm in 100% agreement with that.
Love you all. God bless.
God bless you, too. I will be in touch. And thank you so much for
calling in
and being part of our discussion. Please come back soon and join us. You have a blessed
night.
Thank you.
You too. Love you, too. Keep doing what you're doing, Tony.
I will. I will. Thank you so much.
Surely. Nice listening to everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. You're listening to EIE SOC Radio. I'm your host, Tony Nix. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and the speech that President Obama gave today. So far from what I've heard tonight, there's been a lot of good stuff. That's the only way, excellent stuff, you know, because most of what I've heard tonight, to me, all is in agreement. I know we're going to hear some more as the show goes on, but before we do, I just want to take a brief break. Now, it's going to be a little more than brief, so if you want to hang up and call back in, that's good, but right now, I'm going to play what today was all about. And we'll be right back right after this.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time. Sands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time. Make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. They have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies heavy with the fatigue of travel cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity for whites only. We cannot be satisfied. satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. Yeah. No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. Shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. And all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." "Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Wow, I don't care how many times I hear that speech, I still get chills to this day. You're listening to Enough is Enough, Save Our Children Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Tony Nix. Tonight, we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, reaction to the president's speech that he gave today. I'm going to go right back to the phone lines, and I'm going to bring back Brother Mike X, who has been patient, and I'm grateful for that. Brother Mike, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here, bro. I heard a lot of great comments. I particularly am in agreement, 100%, what I think is Sister Vernita. Vernita, I don't want to say the name wrong.
Oh, Sister Benita. My name is Sister Benita.
I'm in wholehearted agreement with just, with everything that she said. And I feel like that's our first step. When she talked about the conditioning, the mental slavery, to me, it's best dramatized by Booker T. Washington in his book Up From Slavery, when, he was a young boy when the Emancipation Proclamation, came down, and, and Abraham Lincoln ended physical slavery. And he describes it in the book. He's about 5 or 6 years old, and he describes, the man coming up on a horse and reading from a paper, that, the slavery is over. And he talks about, the celebration that sprang up, amongst those who were enslaved. And, they celebrated, and of course, for generations, they had hoped and dreamed that they would one day be free. And he talked about how the celebration went on for about an hour or two. And then, a countenance of sadness, came up on the people who had celebrated. And a little while after that, they began the long trip up to the slave master's house to beg him to stay on, because they had been conditioned to be slaves. They had been stripped of everything that they had needed to be human beings and to be self-determinant, and to, do what they needed to do in order to you know, promote their own self-interest. They had been stripped of that. And so they was dependent now, you know, and they had to go back up to the slave master to ask him to stay on because they knew of no other way. And, you know, though we've had some spectacular moments and some spectacular leaders, you know, who had some spectacular runs, it seems like, you know, those leaders were always dealt with. Those movements were always cut short. And, you know, we were reduced again to being in the position of those people that Booker T. Washington talked about who were dependent upon the slave masters for their food, clothing, and shelter for their very existence. When we talk about public, when we talk about education, you know, we got to be very clear, you know, because public education, the media, you know, itself, it manufactures the status quo, you know, white on top and black on bottom. You know, if you white, you all right. If you brown, you know, stick around. You remember, if you yellow, you mellow. But if you black, stay back. The public education system, the media, it manufactures and maintains the status quo. It maintains that situation of mental slavery where, yeah, we're free physically, but if you control the mental and you control the options that the mental perceives, then you can actually control the people and keep them at a particular level, and that's what's going on. So when we talk about public education, if we just talk about it from that standpoint without qualifying it and send our kids into the schools and talk about, you know, education is what you need, you know, that curriculum manufactures a Eurocentric white mindset. And even if our children are able to move through that battlefield, you know, a lot of times they come out with the perception that even though they have a degree, even though they may have some type of skills, you know, they seek to use it in the context of supporting the system, you know, that is oppressing our people collectively. And then they blame our people. They're used to say, well, such and such did it. How come you can't do it? Such and such did it. How come you can't do it? When such and such is in the vast minority. And the collective that fall under the heels of this mental slavery system are much larger than such and such. You know, W.E.B. Du Bois once talked about the talented tenth, but the talented tenth concept has been turned on us. A lot of our it's like a brain drain going on in our communities. Our best minds, the ones who are able to make it through those killing fields, the education system, they don't see it as their responsibility to come back and bring back the education that they got from the system to empower the black community. Usually the first thing that's on their mind is leaving and assimilating and mixing up with empowered groups, groups that are already historically empowered, and they want to just join on and get a little house in their community and forget the ghetto, forget the neighborhoods that they came out of that are in desperate need for leadership. You know, our greatest leaders have been, every one of our greatest leaders who have sought to empower the grassroots so that we can once and for all carve out and maintain a place of our own in this system. You know, a place of our own, like the Jews have a place of their own, like the Italians have a place of their own, like the Koreans. All of them
and you know
advocated
what, Mike?
That we should have a place of our own. They have been killed off, and it leaves us in the same situation. Go ahead, bro. Go ahead.
Well, hold on a second, because you're making some valid points there. But I want to bring back Sister Benita, because off the air, she brought up something that, you know, is not really spoke on, and I need her to expound on that. Sister Benita, can you please give me that critical thinking piece?
Yes, I was saying I appreciated the buzzword tonight, critical thinking. And in order to do critical thinking, you have to have your faculty available to do that. And when you have been conditioning and you no longer have objectivity, then you don't have access to that region of your brain that can decipher. And so I think that maybe conditioning and critical thinking, maybe if we kind of put those two together, maybe we'll bring a better understanding of what I'm trying to what I'm trying to convey. And like the brother was saying, I have a poem that I wrote called The System, and this is just a piece of the verse. It says, old system wanted us to feel we weren't smart, so they made no reading a law. New system give us crappy schools, can't pass the reading test, so we feel like less, mission accomplished. Now, it doesn't seem like much has changed. Affirmative action, my credentials still downplayed. So at the end of the day, we cannot be competitive with crappy schools. At the end of the day, going through a Eurocentric mindset, my concept of myself is not there to be able to empower the next person that there's something unless you become like the white people. So, yes, I'm for all people, but I think that we don't need to apologize for being Afrocentric. Because there is a need for a positive concept of ourselves to be developed. And I'll end with this. I work for the district attorney's office here, and I work in the school system. We have what we call an early intervention program. And I work right now in the elementary school system where I work with at-risk families. And I deal with children that are already having issues with authority and that sort of thing, and we provide services for them. Well, the key thing that we're having to deal with is behavior modification. And when we talk about conditioning, that's what I'm talking about, is that along with the cognitive part of getting a positive concept about ourselves, there's still things that have to be put in place for us to modify our behavior. And so, yes, positive concept is good, but we're talking about behavior. Black-owned black crime is about a behavior. That's not just feeling bad about yourself and sipping on a 40. You're actually out killing people. Smoking crack and being drugs is a behavior. And so having children out of wedlock is a behavior. So there has to be a balance. And I'm currently working on my master's to be a board-certified behavior analysis because, yes, we need a positive concept of ourselves, but we have to start introducing strategies to produce outcomes that we change our behavior, you know, because laying down and deciding to have sex unprotected is a behavior that goes with a mindset. So I think we're going to begin to get this, and I'm just excited about the conversation that we're having because I think Barack Obama was saying today about choices. A choice is a behavior. It's not just thinking. Choice is a behavior. So how do we make better choices? And that's where we have to get into the conditioning that will allow us to come out of the denial, out of the conditioning so we can make the choice. So in order to become critical thinkers, once again, we have to have our faculties available. So.
And you know what, Sister Benita, it's funny, not funny, it's no coincidence, because when I worked in Arthur Kill State Penitentiary here in New York City, Staten Island, to be exact, one of my main workshops was behavior modification, you know, because I knew that these convicts who had been down for 10 years or better could not come into society with a mindset like they had without behavior modification, because it was going to lead them back to the penitentiary or they were going to die. So that is so important, and that is one of the biggest workshops that we need to be offering our youth and young adults. And as you said, the young mothers who repeatedly have child after child after child, you know, we have to get them in there. We have to get them to these workshops because that is really needed, really needed. You know, we have to let them see what their behaviors are resulting in and how to modify that behavior, how to change that behavior, you know. And, I mean, it's a task in itself. I find that people that are incarcerated, convicts, not inmates, seem to grasp it quicker than those who are not incarcerated. You know, I don't know. That's just my experience. But behavior modification is one of the biggest things we need in what we do in our communities as far as changing our youth mindset. I'm going to go back to Doc Scott and get his view on this because Doc's been real patient. Doc, hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. You hit on a couple of things. I think behavior is a function of belief system, and I think we've had a long time. Your aunt hit upon something that I think President Obama hit up talked about too. I think that conditioning plays a part, but I no longer believe that. I wouldn't put all of my eggs in the conditioning basket, because there's been too many folks that look like us that are very successful because they had family backing that had high expectations and said that you can do it, and the support of those families, and they went through poor school systems and that said that you could do it, and we've been successful in the systems. And by understanding the systems and working through them, so conditioning has an effect. But also, I can't buy conditioning does it all. And so I won't put all of my eggs in the conditioning basket. Conditioning does have an effect. But President Obama said some things to me that, looking at it from a critical thinking perspective, makes a lot of sense to me. And what I look at is accepting part of it, and that I think has been overlooked is responsibility, and that is personal responsibility, that as a community we're going to have to at some point in time accept some personal responsibility and do some critical thinking, and education is the key. And I think part of the issue too is getting out of the blame game, and I think being able to look at it from a systems perspective. And by that I mean this thing is a system. And by that, people that have been on top want to stay on top, that are a minority, they are doing everything they can to stay on top, and understanding it as looking at it from a system perspective of, if I were on top, I'd do everything I could to stay on top too. And looking at it from that perspective, we have to continue to do what we started many, many years ago, over 300 years ago, and keep our eye on the prize, because we have come a long way, and do it in the way that I think President Obama has set out and continued. And I think we have to continue that road. I think education is the key. I think voting rights is the key. And I think each one of us has to do our part in a calculated one-on-one way, in a non-blaming, drawing people in a from my perspective, in a colorless way, Because to me, what I keep hearing is this separation color way. But when I look across those crowds, as I watched the TV screen 50 years ago, there was a whole lot of black and white. And that's what Brother Martin Luther King was talking about. And so I think we got to continue the struggle. And so I'm continuing my struggle, and I've had lots of success with it, and I'm going to keep on keeping on. And I don't have any blame for anybody. And so I'm here listening, and I've got to get off his phone because I've got to take care of my daughter who is in Alabama.
I appreciate you joining us tonight. Real brief before you go, though. I understand what you're saying, and I understand Brother Mike X and Sister Benita. What I get from them is, you know, we got to do better with us, and there's nothing wrong with doing better with us or being pro us. Being pro us, and I'm a believer of this, doesn't mean I'm anti them, if you follow what I'm saying. At the same time,
no,
I understand. Okay, well, hold on, Doc. There is a them. There is a them. I feel that there is a them. Okay, your view is different, but there is a them. Okay, them, as you said, are going to stay on top as long as they can stay on top. We're trying to get there. But what our issue, one of our issue is the inability to take personal responsibility for our own crap. Okay? That's what we're struggling with, okay? So there's some things about us that we need to change. And until we grasp that and do that, we're going to keep doing the same thing. That's all I'm saying. Now, listen, I got other callers on the line. I don't want to keep you, but thank you for calling in tonight. I really appreciate it. Keep calling. I need your support. I love you a lot, my man. You know, there's
love
no you without you. All right? I'm going to go to my next caller.
Right.
That's the co-founder of Enough is Enough. Dave, our children, actually, you know, she drafted me into this, you know, and I sometimes still say, my God, what has she done? You know, she put this on my shoulder. But that's okay. You know, God does the way he does things. So let me bring in my co-founder of Enough is Enough, Save Our Children. And that is Lynn Miller. Lynn, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me? Is everything
yes,
everybody can hear me?
Yes, we can. Welcome to the night show. Missed you.
Thank you. And you're exactly where you're supposed to be, and you know that.
Okay.
And you know that. You know what? Now I'm kind of coming in on the end of this, so
right.
I'm gonna, you know, be brief and just kind of give my view from what I've heard. And it's just, I think I'm a little older and, you know, we experienced, you know, the marches with what I came home to on my TV, you know what I mean? Like, everybody marching and stuff. So I'm sorry. I'm speaking on the computer because my phone wouldn't work for whatever reason.
Okay.
So I apologize for the background noise. But what I look at is, if we're going to make any real effect, and Doc did bring this up, and I totally, totally agree, it has to be very calculated. We have to first understand where we're at. You know, like, if we don't actually understand where we're standing at the moment, there's not going to be any, there'll be a lot of confusion. We'll do this, what we do all the time. If those of us who know or have ideas, okay, well, so we sit together and we kind of sing to the choir, and then I don't see anything. You know what I mean? That's just the way I feel. But to actually look at where we're at, we've been conditioned to be where we're at. Our children are conditioned. I mean, just our school systems have conditioned our children. And when President Obama is talking about taking on your responsibility, I totally believe in that. I think we should have been done that for I don't know how long. But we still do have to know that we've been conditioned to be where we're at, in other words. Like, we're segregated in these neighborhoods on purpose. Believe me, you're surrounded by bad schools and bad food, you know, because it's not just behavior modification, and that's the way I see it, because I come from the biopsychosocial background. Biology, nobody in the black neighborhood is going to the doctor. So you're not feeling well. You're not taking care of yourself. Mostly, this is what's going on. I'm not talking about the people that are here on this call right now, and that's what I was talking about earlier about singing to the choir. Psychologically, you've been drilled. If you come from a poor neighborhood and you go to a public school, they ring bells, don't they? They ring bells when you change class. They're teaching you to go to a factory and or to jail, period. They're treating you like Pavlov's dogs. I went to private school. I never heard of bells. You understand? People in our neighborhoods have been conditioned to be exactly as they are, to react in the animalistic way that they are reacting because they are corralled. This is prison. This is prison. My neighborhood is prison. People don't want to admit it. It is prison. Anytime you're afraid to walk out and go to your store at my age, right now at night, it's 10 at night, I really wouldn't want to walk to the store by myself. And you know what? It's the young men that are supposed to be protecting me. And why? They've been conditioned by the system that we live under to believe that they're animals. And we reinforce it. Now that's, you know, Tony, this is not a blame game. This is an understanding of where we're at. Stop blaming everything. If we understand where we're at, we can start from where we're at. Please understand it. These young people, they don't know where they're going because most of all their parents don't know where they're going because their grandparents haven't been taught where to go. You can't go home and learn. You can't go home and learn what's not there. It's not even given to you. The opportunity of that knowledge is not even afforded you. So how can I even think maybe that you would even have a slight inkling of how to act in the street? How? How can it happen? I'm sorry, but you know, my heart hurts for these children. Hurts. They're living in jail. We're all living in jail. We're all living in jail right now. We've been segregated and cut off and given the lowest, the most cheapest, horrible schools. We're given the toughest police. The kids can't even walk down the street without being looked at because they're walking down the street. We want to talk about the sagging pants, and honestly, you know, oh my God, they drive me crazy. But I remember my mother getting on me about bleaching. I had one leg of my pants bleached and the other one wasn't bleached, and I ripped the shirt because it was cool. I get a pair of jeans and sandpaper. All that sounds like, you know, we have to remember we did that too. We have to start thinking about these children. These are the ones that we need to talk to. These are the ones that we need to say good morning to when we're there in the store. Stop avoiding them. Good morning. How many of us can actually admit that the kids that walk down your street every day that you see going to school every day that you speak to, do you step out and say, hi, good morning, how y'all doing?
Then you know you have some very, very valid points. That's okay.
Yeah.
You have some very valid points that you're making, and you know, as I said, it's time to do some different things. And yes, we have to have the understanding of what's going on for sure. Okay.
Right.
Today, I mean, with the whole pants down and how our young women look today, I don't like it. I gotta say that. You know, yes, we did
some things, you know, like you mentioned, jeans, the bleached jeans. At the same time, there was some substance of self-pride. You know, there was some self-pride. Today, there is none. There is, you know, we got a bunch of angry youth out there and young adults. A lot of them don't even know why they're so angry. They're just angry, you know. So, you know, we have that understanding of what's going on. And, yes, it is time for more reaching out. You know, we always say stop looking back and reach back. So that is part of what we need to start doing, you know. And some of us are doing it. It's just we need more. The more, the better the results. That's what my view of it. I got one more call on the line, and I'm going to give final comments, and I'm going to close for the night. But, Lynn, thank you so much, okay? Let me take this last call, and that's Sister Nicole. Sister Nicole, do you have a comment tonight? Welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. To address something that Sister Lynn just said, I am the neighborhood parent. So pretty much when the kids see me in the area, the teenagers and the little ones, because my kids are so far apart in age, you know, I'm the parent everybody comes to talk to and joke with and so on and so forth. But the one comment I wanted to make, where actually we have an issue, is so many of us are not politicians, but we spend too much of our time trying to be politically correct. Just because society is saying it's okay does not mean that it is okay for our households, our children, and our community. And we need to speak up on that and not worry about looking or appearing to be not accepting of what they're making the norm, you know, because the bottom line is if you truly are not accepting it, then stand up for that. You know, if you feel it's wrong, stand up for that, you know, and we need to really, truly stop trying to be politically correct and fit in, you know, and there's no room for us to fit into something that's destroying our children, it's destroying our morals, it's destroying our family values. And there's so many different things that we could touch upon that fall into that bracket. You know, the teenage pregnancy, the way that people are dressing, not, you know, people are scared to speak to each other's children. The neighbors are no longer responsible for the children of the community. Everybody is about me and my household. You know, we need to come back together as a community and all be responsible for all, versus just me being responsible for me. And that's pretty much what I gathered from, you know, what I'm seeing going on today and being accountable. You know, being accountable for myself also means being accountable for my community and those around me. And that's pretty much all I had to say for tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for giving us that. And, yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely right. I'm going to get final comments, and we're going to close for the night, and I'm going to start off with Sister Bonita. Good evening, Sister. Can you hear me?
Good evening. Yes, I can. I picked up some good points tonight. I appreciate the sister that says we have to understand where we are, and that's a very, very critical piece to planning. And I think we've been hitting on conditioning. I heard a brother talk about systems, and another sister just kind of bounced back on that these systems that are in place have conditioned us. And, yes, we have had people that have made it through the system, but a part of that behavior modification, we know that support is necessary. So when you have people in your corner telling you you can do something and you can overcome, then that is a piece for behavior modification. So I agree with the doctor that was saying we definitely don't need to blame anybody, but we do need to look at the situation realistically where it is. And a child that is not told who he is, from the standpoint that he's something good or she's something good and can become something, it will not happen through osmosis. So
it's a twofold part. We have conditioning systems in place, but at the end of the day, we need support, support, support. And it's not going to just happen with a speech. It's going to take a lot of work. And so I appreciate the opportunity to be on the line and comment and have appreciated everybody's comments. Thank you.
And we appreciate you, sister. Thank you. Join us again real soon. You're always welcome, dear. Have a blessed night. Brother Mike,
thank
final
you.
Comment. Brother Mike, can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm here, brother.
Okay, final comment, brother. Real brief.
Yeah. You know, I just say, you know, I have a dream, too. You know, I have a dream that one day we'll, as a people, black people, that we'll take responsibility for ourselves, you know, for learning to love ourselves again, for learning to, you know, have faith in ourselves and our ability to make wise choices, you know, for our ability to submit to one another instead of striving to be unoffensive or loving of people outside of our experience first, that we'll learn the importance of putting ourselves first so that we can heal and we can strengthen ourselves. You know, you can't love anybody else until you first love yourself. You know, so this is where our first responsibility and priority should lie. And as far as education is concerned, you know, I would like us to begin to qualify it. We need a new face on what black education should be, because what education does for other people, particularly white people, is not going to do for ourselves. Our education should be about helping us to heal, helping us to have faith in ourselves, to learn how to be self-determining, and, you know, and breaking free of depending upon the liberal establishment and even the black icons, you know, and become part of that leadership ourselves in our own lives and our own neighborhoods. So that's all I'm going to say. Peace to the family.
Peace, Mike, and thank you for joining us again, my brother. And, I agree. I truly agree. You know, self-love first. I'm a believer in that. Learn how to love self so you can love others. And that is a piece that we definitely need. So thanks again, and peace and blessings to you, brother. Final comment, Lynn.
Hi. I love what Mike just said. I most certainly did. You have to be proud of whoever you are. You know, me personally, I'm mixed race, and I'm proud of me. You know, as a human being, I think I'm a good person. The system, I've been blessed to be a part, maybe on the other side of that system. And I got the good education. And it just makes me very humble, because a lot of times I think, you know, see the way to, for me, the system that we're talking about, this system affects everybody. Even when I say everybody, it goes up to Wall Street. They've been conditioned to be the sharks that they are. And we've been conditioned to be, and I hate to say this, the S word, the slaves that we are, all of us. The human race is a slave. We're living on a slave ship. We're in jail, and nobody's really. That's where we have to realize this is where we're at, and we need to. The president just told us you're going to have to pick up yourselves by your bootstraps. He just told us you better get together. We need to do this. We need to talk more about this and get together, actually. You know? And that's my final comment.
Well, thanks, Lynn. I'm glad you joined us. You got to come back and be a part of our shows, because you have been missing it lately, okay?
Yeah.
they've been bringing the fire on here, okay? But I know you're busy, but please, as often as you can, please come and be a part of our discussion. All right?
Okay.
You stay blessed, and I'll talk to you real soon.
I love you, Tony.
Nicole, final comment.
My final comment is pretty much, you know, basically to recap what everyone's saying, the accountability. You know, start within yourself, analyze yourself, check yourself, you know, correct yourself, and, you know, let that, you know, manifest into your household, your communities, and, you know,
you know, let that light shine within yourself so that others can look at you and see you being an example, you know, and feel that it's okay. You know, it's too many of us that are afraid to display our education and speak well and so on and so forth for the fear of, you know, being seen as, you know, someone else or trying to be someone else, you know, and we need to let our people know that we are educated, you know, we are intelligent, we are articulate, you know, and it's not a matter of being someone else, we are being ourselves, and that's it.
That's right. That's right. And thank you for that. That needed to be heard. Nicole, thank you, baby. Appreciate it. We'll be in touch, and you have a blessed and safe night, okay?
You too, Rob. Thank you.
You've been listening to Enough is Enough, Save Our Children, Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Tony Nix. We were talking about the reaction to President Obama's speech today, earlier today, on the anniversary of the March on Washington. Heard a lot of good comments tonight, you know, and, you know, I sum it all up to we have a lot of work to do, and we have to strategize the work that we do. We can't worry about whether we sound politically correct. That stood out. It's time for critical thinking. It's time for self-love. Being anti-black doesn't necessarily make folks anti-white. And I think it is a big error for those who feel differently than that to feel that way. Not when it's said that if you're not white, white is going to stay on top no matter what. Well, in order for black to get there, black has to do some things. Black folks have to do some things. And one of the first things we got to do is be pro-us. Now, there's people that's going to disagree, and that's okay. But I'm a believer in being pro-us. Because where we're at right now, that's where the mindset we need to pick up to become pro-black. Pro-black doesn't mean being anti anyone else. It's about self-love and love of your people and the conditions they are in. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't even believe God would frown on that. So listen. Those who have been listening tonight, if you've gotten anything out of this, know that there are some changes that we need to make. There are some strategies that we need to use. And I heard quite a few tonight. Quite a few. Yes, we need to become better educated. Boy, what's going on here? I'm getting tongue-tied. Yes, there is a system in place that the education that some of our children receive is not the greatest. Still, I'm a believer of to function in the United States of America, you need to know that system. And also, if you do your history into seeking out what black history and how far back it goes, you may find out that this European system came from black folks. Now, don't take it from me. Do a little homework. I believe us not knowing our entire history in the world, not just America, will enlighten quite a few of us. Quite a few of us. Find out how a lot of systems came into play. And who were the originators of these systems? You'll be very surprised to find out. So, let's get it done. Let's get it done. We've been talking about it. Let's be about it. I'm an activist against gun violence here in Southeast Queens, New York. President and founder of Enough is Enough, Save Our Children. There's a crisis in America, gun violence, being perpetrated by our youth and young adults in every inner city across the nation. There is not one inner city in America that does not suffer from the plague of gun violence. This isn't normal living. We need to do something about it. We can't sit back and accept it as it's okay. As the sister said earlier, we should be able to walk out to the store anytime without the fear of maybe being shot, catching a bullet that don't even belong to you. Our children should be able to play in parks without the fear of being shot. This has gone on far too long, and it is past time, for folks to get involved. Nobody else is going to do it for us. This has to be a people movement. This has to be a we thing, not a me thing. Ask yourself, what are you going to do? Don't wait till it knocks on your door and then you want to get involved. Get involved now. Don't wait till you lose a loved one to now you want to stand up and fight. Fight now. Make a stand now, because now is the time. We're asleep at the wheel. Gotta wake up. Gotta wake up. Our children need us. Our young adults need us. Young women who are having child after child after child after child, they need a wake up. They need to know that somebody cares, that they're not on their own and they're not alone. It don't take much. It starts off with a simple, how you doing? Listen, again, Enough is Enough, Save Our Children. You can find us on Facebook, or you can go directly to our website, enoughisenoughsaveourchildren.org. You can register, and please, make a donation. Our email is eie.saveourchildren@gmail.com. Telephone number, 347-829-4084. Become part of the solution. We know what the problem is, and one of the problems is not enough people are stepping up. But guess what? Dr. King had a dream. Part of the dream has come true, a very small part of the dream. But there's a bigger part of that dream that needs to come into reality. And it's up to us to make it happen. And as President Obama said, yes, we can. Not yes, he can. Yes, we can. Stop thinking it's all up to him, because it's not. It begins and ends with us, but we got to put in the work. We got to start to believe in ourselves again. We got to rid ourselves of this hopeless mindset, because that is a lie. It is not hopeless. There is still hope, and there will always be hope. If it's going to be a long journey, sure it is. Sure it is. There's going to be obstacles that you're going to have to climb over, but we can get over them as a people. And what a mindset of, yes, we can. See, right now is our time. It's our time. We got a family sitting in the White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. They are an example of what we can do if we show each other how to get there. It's each one teach one, people. Listen, If no one told you they loved you today, God does, and so do I. My name is Tony Nix. I'll talk to you real soon. And as always, the sooner that we have no violence in our communities, the sooner we will know peace. That's KNOW. Deuces. Good night, everyone.
Together, I've been a kind of protection that's all around.